Welcome to the Young Wealth Show, where you'll truly learn how to make, spend, and invest money for an awesome life. Get the real life stuff that wasn't part of your school curriculum. Young Wealth gives you innovative new ways of dealing with your finances, as well as the skills and tools you're going to need to survive and be successful out on your own. Let the Young Wealth Show be your GPS to take you from clueless to clued in. Here is your host, Jason Hartman, with Young Wealth.
Hey, welcome to the Young Wealth Show. This is Jason Hartman, your host. Thanks for listening. Check out our website at youngwealth.com or jasonhartmanfoundation.org. We're glad to have you here back listening to show number 2. We've got a whole bunch of shows we recorded for you, but we haven't launched them yet, so they'll be out soon. Today, we're going to talk about financial planning and investments for young adults and how you can get a good head start in life and have a lot more financial literacy than your friends and the people you know so that you can move ahead and you don't become a slave to the man, okay? You want to move ahead so you're financially independent. And I did this early in my 20s. I was making a lot of money and I was doing real well. I was buying rental properties. I was doing investments. I was making a lot of money in my business as a real estate broker. And I just want to help you do that too. So that's what we're here for. We'll cover a lot of different topics on the Young Wealth Show. The next one, we'll probably do our 11 commandments of Young Wealth, and just got a lot of great stuff coming up. So today I interviewed a financial planner and author of several books, and he was interesting, had some great tips, great advice. So let's listen into the interview and join us on the next show when we do show number 3. Here's our guest today. My pleasure to welcome Jim Lowell to the show. He's the author of Investing from Scratch, a handbook for the young investor. Jim, welcome.
Jason, good to be here.
Well, glad to have you. Tell us what a young person really needs to know to start their financial life off right.
Well, the most important thing that a young investor needs to know is that they have time in their favor. Unlike their parents and grandparents, where the clock is ticking, young investors can really take some measurable risks across a broad spectrum of different types of investments in order to be able to secure a truly bright financial future.
Well, that's great. What do they do to do that? Do you want to sort of divide it up into different areas of investing? I know your background is really in stocks and paper assets.
I mean, you always have to start with your own bottom line. So the most crucial aspect of getting started as an investor is making sure that you've covered all the other relevant financial planning bases in your life. That means that you need to be employed, you need to be earning more than you're spending, and you also need to have a good sense of what sort of benefits are coming to you by way of your employer, in particular healthcare, the most overlooked but most critical investment for a young investor, all the way up to a 401k plan, so that you can basically allocate your incoming resources to better invest in your own financial future. So I would never recommend that anyone invest in the stock market, first of all, unless and until they had at least 3 to 6 months of their average monthly expenses in cash in a bank savings account, especially in environments like this, where layoffs are still the rule rather than the exception to it. You need to have some funds set away for a rainy day. They're going to happen to you. They happen to everyone along the arc of your overall life career. But once you've done that, once you have saved enough to basically cover 3 to 6 months of your living expenses, you can truly begin to take advantage of, in very small increments, the time that you have in front of you. The compounded interest on an investment of $10,000 spanned over 40 years worth of time will not make you a millionaire, but it'll make you fairly close to one. As opposed to someone who's just starting today and only has 10 years to go, that $10,000 would maybe be about $25,000, hardly enough to even account for 1 year's worth of medical expenses.
So really, you're saying, of course, the advantage that the young investor has is taking advantage of compound interest or compound returns.
Absolutely right. And in an environment like the one that we are facing today, where virtually every asset class has been cut in half, the reality is that for young investors, they could be far more creative than most young investors think they can be. I think areas that are very attractive in this marketplace, you have to be careful because this is in some sense regional, but multifamily homes here on the East Coast, where especially if you're a first-time home buyer and can get it incentivized from the government and also deliver some rental income to yourself, makes considerable sense as sort of a core asset. And then in the stock market, a good diversified mutual fund like a Vanguard Index 500 fund or Fidelity Magellan fund, where the minimum investment is a few thousand dollars, certainly makes great sense as a way to diversify across a broad spectrum of the domestic and global stock markets without having to know each individual stock. You're basically buying a product that diversifies across a range of global stocks, and in so doing, you'll be able to learn as you go about the types of individual stocks that are in that portfolio.
So you started off with a real big advantage to the young investor is the advantage of compounding returns or compounding interest, because starting early, and I definitely agree with you, that is so important. However, one of the big problems I think the young will face, I mean, everybody will face it, and that is the prospect of some very significant looming inflation. Now, people can split hairs and debate the issue, but eventually it has to come, I think. And that can really diminish that return.
It does so in a, it sounds awfully theoretical. First of all, I agree with you. Inflation is coming down the road, whether it's 3 months or 3 years. It'll be a headwind that everyone will have to face. And while it may sound overly theoretical, it's pretty simple to put it into perspective. Inflation, if inflation is running at, let's say, 3 to 5%, well, that means that out of every dollar, you're going to lose 3 to 5% in terms of its purchasing power. So you're going to have 95 cents on that dollar. And you're going to have to make up that gap and then some in order to be able to outpace the toll that inflation will take on the purchasing power of your dollars. And some inside of some asset classes, there are instruments that are better equipped to fight the headwinds of an inflationary environment. On the stock side, it tends to be growth stocks with high earnings, so technology, healthcare, two great areas. In the fixed income marketplace, the flight to treasuries, which was spurred by last year's market meltdown, is absolutely the wrong place to be, but there are great diversified exchange-traded funds and mutual funds that invest in things like inflation-protected bonds and junk bonds, which sound fairly frightening, but currently yielding north of 9% and delivering a total return year-to-date. Let's see, Fidelity High Income's up over 40% year-to-date. They are economically sensitive and tend to trade up in inflationary environments. And then, of course, real estate, smartly done, can also help you basically fight the tide and the toll that inflationary environments tend to exact on every investor, young or old.
Let me ask you about the bond topic, if I can, Jim. One of the things I think that is pretty deceiving about the bond world is quoting the true inflation rate. So now we have very, very mild inflation. We've experienced some deflation, and it's just recently the tables have slightly turned, but it's almost not even worth talking about. It's so minimal. But the usual rate of inflation is about, if you look at the past 35 years, you're at about 5.1%, I believe. The problem is that the way they counted that starting in the 80s really changed a lot. And you started having these different ways to manipulate the index, from substitution to hedonic adjustments. And either you or I can explain that a little bit to the listeners. But the point being that the consumer price index, which is one of the broad measures for inflation, is really questionable as to its accuracy, don't you think? And so when you compare that to bonds, especially now, stocks, different, real estate a little different, but bonds, because they're fixed income, I think there you've got a potential to possibly make a mistake. Yes, no?
You clearly do. And it's not just a question of what the benchmark index is and how that index is created and what sort of prejudices it imputes into an accurate or inaccurate reading of inflation, but it's also clearly related to what I would call investor psychology. And investors do have a herd mentality and trend towards wherever everyone else seems to be buying. And so I think the biggest risk on the fixed income side today is that the majority of investors continue, and we saw it again just yesterday with another oversubscribed treasury auction, investors continue to buy intermediate and long-term treasuries at, I would say, bubble-like prices with absolutely a zero-sum gain in terms of the yield advantage. And also, the purchase of those instruments is introducing an exponential level of inflation, interest rate-related risk into portfolios of both old and young investors.
You know what, Jim, since we're talking to a crowd of probably 20-something listeners pretty much, do you want to explain a little bit how that works. Some of the language you just used is pretty technical.
Sure.
I've been around this a long time. I understand it. But what is the dynamic? Okay, so the U.S. wants to raise money for its irresponsible government spending. Not that I have an opinion about that or anything. but they want to do that. And so they print money, they have treasury auctions, and foreign countries mostly come to those treasury auctions and they buy the T-bills, right?
Correct.
How does that all work? Just explain that, if you would, a little bit in very simple terms.
Sure. I mean, the treasury auction, like most auctions, is basically a window into people's appetites for either managing risk or managing return. And what we are seeing still is a considerable interest among both domestic and foreign investors investing in riskless, or they are perceived to be riskless, instruments, treasury instruments. The reason they're perceived to be riskless is that they're backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government and its ability to levy taxes on its constituents in order to be able to repay the debt instruments. Now, we have never been in a period of such unbridled and unregulated government spending. It's very important to remember, though, that no government can spend without having to borrow. And so the pressure that's going to be brought to bear on treasury bonds in particular will be that it's not only an inflationary pressure, there could be a real crisis in confidence of the U.S. government's inability to be able to tax its constituents enough to be able to repay the debt. Those are two headwinds facing the treasury market as we see it today.
Right. And so we just had a treasury auction, I believe, 2 days ago, right? And you're saying that one went pretty well?
It was oversubscribed, which was remarkable, given that for the prior 3 weeks, we had seen both earnings and economic data support rather than supplant the notion that we are on the road to economic recovery.
So that auction went well. I do hear some people saying that the auctions are getting kind of rigged, where the Federal Reserve is acting as a shill buying those treasury bills, and we're not really seeing an open market.
We have had successive, quote-unquote, record treasury auctions going back over 3 months.
Okay.
And on a rolling sort of biweekly basis.
Do you think that's really all legit, or is some of that propped up? I mean, none of us really know, I guess, but I hear that sort of more conspiratorial tone about it.
It wouldn't surprise me if there is some repurchasing going on that basically inflates both the velocity, the level of interest in the auction, and the outcome of the auction. It would be hard to say that, and it would be hard to, in fact, make it the case that the whole thing was rigged in that way. I think the reality on the ground is that while we are heading towards stabilization, so we fell off a cliff but landed on a ledge, and whether we can climb up or have further to fall, time will tell. There are other countries, like Japan, for example, where just because of the aging population, you know, their demographic bubble is one that's now basically has a population where the majority of people are savers and in retirement as opposed to investors and growing through the economy.
And that's been one of the big problems with Japan and why they've had the lost, as it's called, the lost decade, where they don't have the demographics. They're not having any kids.
They absolutely don't. They have a negative population rate. They have over 40,000 people that are aged 100 or older.
And they're living too long.
And so this is not a population that's going to put assets into their stock market. And so Japan is almost by force having to purchase things like U.S. Treasuries. On the flip side, China, where growth remains, if you can believe their numbers, remarkable, there may be a case for selling treasuries in favor of some other currencies, even in their own neck of the woods.
I really like the way your book is laid out. Got to compliment you on that. And you just sort of take everything from scratch, as the title would imply. One thing I found particularly interesting is chapter 20 talks about investment clubs. It's called Investment Clubs from Scratch. What about investment clubs? I mean, are you talking about real estate or stock clubs or both?
They can be both. I mean, the reality is that I grew up around a dinner table where the discussion among the generations was always stocks, bonds, cash, not Red Sox, Yankees. I didn't even know that sports existed in any sort of real way.
That's what I always say. My kid will be like Alex Keaton from that old show, Family Ties. He'll be the financial guy, you know?
Absolutely.
Right.
It wasn't until college that I knew there was another world of data and statistics to be passionate about. And investment clubs, especially if you did not grow up in a family where it was stocks, bonds, cash at the dinner table, they're a great way to, first of all, come together with like-minded people who are interested and passionate about learning, about how to get started, how to invest, and members, many members of investment clubs may have been investing for, 20 years or more, so you might be able to find a good mentor. Of course, the risks are that some investment clubs require that you actually invest in the portfolio of their recommendations. I would take sort of a cautious approach to investment clubs that pre-exist your participation. But there's no reason that you can't start your own investment club with a handful of friends and once a week or once a month get together and just compare your notes on what you see as happening in both the economic landscape as well as the stock, the bond, the real estate landscapes. One of the things that has happened over the last decade, and of course this generation doesn't even think about having to know it or learn it, is that with information technology and the successive evolutions over the last decade, so much information, good information, is really available right, with the click of a mouse, not even or the touch of a screen. I mean, really dramatically different from even just 10 years ago, where research could often take days just to come to what a simple click can divulge in this day and age. Another good reason for investment clubs is that there's a lot of sort of misdirection out there in terms of the difference between quality research and research that's obviously just trying to sell you a point of view or sell you a product. So an investment club is a great way to bring up an idea.
You're so polite and politically correct the way you say that. There's a lot of misdirection. I call it fraud and scumbags pushing bad assets.
Absolutely. So, you don't want to buy what you're sold just because it's being sold to you. So investment clubs are a great way to bring up ideas and then have them batted down. One of the great lessons in life is to make sure that you have friends who don't simply agree with your point of view, but who you can trust when they challenge your point of view. That is absolutely essential when it comes to investing.
Good point. On that note of being sold investments, do you want to talk maybe just for a quick moment? I got a lot of stuff I want to cover with you, so let's just keep them quick. But the financial press, I think it's sort of the default, and I think a young person could get sucked into this very easily of just subscribing to Money Magazine and reading that, or even a better publication like the Wall Street Journal, which I actually really like. But a lot of these magazines, it seems as though they're just kind of catering or pandering to their advertisers. You read the article next to the ad for Merrill Lynch or whatever. It seems kind of biased to me, doesn't it?
There's a lot of bias out there. It's not just between MSNBC and Fox. And you definitely
CNBC.
Want to make sure that your resources are credible and authoritative and, to the greatest extent possible, independent. The other issue that I would have with a Money magazine or a Smart Money or even a Kiplinger's, while the articles are well-researched, well-written, and I would say on the whole likely to be unbiased, the reality is that they always arrive 3 to 4 months after the columnist has written them. So they're a day late and usually many dollars short. The good news is that with sites like, WSJ.com, WallStreetJournal.com, great, but it's a paid-for site for most of the information. But MarketWatch.com does a great job, and I'm slightly biased because, of course, I'm a columnist on MarketWatch, but I know that the people that I write alongside of there are certainly independent-minded and usually fairly focused on delivering not just more information, but better investment advice. Bloomberg.com is a great resource, especially for the young investor trying to come up to speed on all the different terms and what they mean and how they relate to each other. Bloomberg does a phenomenal job so that if you have, for example, a GDP number like we had today, third quarter GDP, our gross domestic product, first look at sort of how the economy overall was faring during the third quarter, you could not only find out the number, find out what consensus estimate was, find out whether it beat or disappointed, but you can also just click through to a definition of what GDP is and why it matters. So I'm often inclined to start my day looking at four sites. I go to Bloomberg.com, MarketWatch.com for my market insights, noise, general sort of trend of news and velocity of information. And then I always click through to CNN.com and the Drudge Report to help counterbalance each other's biases and get a general lay of the land in terms of where the general momentum of the day is likely to drift. And so with those four sites, those really do serve as sort of the cornerstones of my daily news diet. Much beyond that, It usually gets either overwhelming or underwhelming pretty quickly.
Yeah. So that's for someone who's looking at markets and things on a day-to-day basis, which I think a fairly small number of people actually have time to do it that way. But Chapter 7 in your book is entitled Useful Economics from Scratch. Can you talk maybe about some of the basics of economics or some indicators that a person starting out needs to become familiar with to know which way things are going?
Most young investors approach the term economics the way they approach the term calculus. In other words, with a lot of anxiety.
Not too excited about it, yeah.
and not too much excitement. But economics, the word itself, comes from the Greek economoi, which means household or taking care of one's household. And the reality is that economics is nothing other than a lens through which to view the world as it exists and as it grows and contracts on a daily or a monthly or an annual basis. So economics really is just the study of what is out there. And one of the things you need to do very quickly is get up to speed on some key economic mileposts. In particular, there's some terminology, very easy to comprehend. And once you do, it really does sort of open up your own eyes to how everything in life is virtually an economic transaction. From your purchasing of your Starbucks coffee all the way through to having to pay for the person who's making that coffee, having to get the beans to Starbucks, having to pay the shipper, having to build the vehicles to ship the coffee, all the way through. I mean, you can really take any grain of sand and see a long-lived economic chain of events that can help you not only better understand the world in which we live, but also better comprehend where the investment opportunities and risks lie. One of the things that I always pay attention to are leading economic indicators. These are indicators that cover everything from, let's say, consumer spending and their habits, consumer confidence, whether or not they're feeling bolder or more cowed. It certainly includes some key housing data, existing home sales, new home sales, mortgage applications, builders' confidence. All of these data points, while they can sound fairly random, really when you begin to look at them and revisit them on a quarterly basis, begin to lay out a very basic map of not just the economy, but the marketplace of where you may or may not want to invest.
Good stuff there. How can someone understand sort of focusing, if you would, on the stock market just for a minute? And can you talk about the different aspects of it? I mean, it's so complex. It's amazing. And I'm not saying how to predict it, just how to understand what you're dealing with in a stock market. You've got stocks, you've got mutual funds, you've got ETFs, you've got options.
It's all over the map.
Right.
And for a young investor with a small amount of money to get started, I still think the best way to do so is through a no-load, actively managed mutual fund. Now, a mutual fund is just a collection of shares in companies, a diversified basket of shares in companies that's overseen by a manager whose job it is to outperform a standard benchmark, if we're talking about a growth fund, like the S&P 500. The statistics will tell you, John Bogle, formerly of Vanguard, is right when he says that 80% plus of mutual fund managers fail to beat their benchmark, and that's his case for investing in an index fund, an unmanaged basket of stocks in, say, the S&P 500. But the reality is that even if you take John Bogle at face value and that statement at face value, that still means that there's 20% of actively managed fund managers who do beat their benchmark, and that is also true, and they're also not that hard to find. And companies like even Vanguard, which has several great actively managed no-load funds, Fidelity, T. Rowe Price, all of them offer really some spectacular ways to get started with very little money, typically between $500 for an IRA and $2,500 in a taxable account. And when you buy one share in a mutual fund, like, let's say, Fidelity Magellan, what that one share in that one fund does is enable you to participate in a basket of almost 300 stocks that are run by the manager. And so you can very quickly begin, just by focusing even in on just the top 10 stocks in Fidelity Magellan, you can begin to get up to speed on the way in which the different stocks, the different companies in that portfolio behave under different market conditions. So when you look at a fund like Fidelity Magellan, and I don't get paid for saying this, it doesn't serve me well or ill, although I do like the fund, when you look at a fund like Fidelity Magellan, you really can open your eyes very quickly to the world of investing as a whole in not just the domestic stock market, but the global stock market as well. The top 10 holdings in Fidelity Magellan are Nokia, which, of course, communication, Corning, that's electronic equipment, Applied Materials, semiconductors, Staples, Medco Health, which is a healthcare provider, Newmont Mining, that's a play on the gold market, Goldman Sachs, obviously a financial services play, Bank of America.
Well, isn't Goldman Sachs just the U.S. government?
Yep.
I'm being sarcastic there, but not that it's untrue.
not that it's untrue. Yeah. J.P. Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo. So just in those top 10 names, you have a basket of global bellwether stocks.
Sure.
And just by following those top 10 names, just by plugging them into a live portfolio on a market watch or an E-Trade, you can really begin to see how they move in relationship to the news of the day. And there are great object lessons inside of it. So no-load funds are still my single most preferred way for young investors to get started.
Good stuff. So that's kind of the basics of that. Now, one criticism I would have for mutual funds is that every mutual fund, so far as I know, is going long on the market. In other words, assuming that the market will appreciate in value, when people that have followed that strategy up until about 5-6 months ago were slaughtered, frankly. I wish there were mutual funds that went short on the market, that assumed the market was going to take a downturn, because that seems to be something you can predict also, or at least invest in, as well as it taking an upturn. You can't play both sides of that, though, huh?
And playing both sides requires, I would say, a degree of sophistication that is usually most suited for investors that have had, I would say, several years worth of experience. Yeah, that said, on the exchange-traded fund side of the fence, and exchange-traded funds are like an index fund in that they're a basket of stocks, but they're like a stock, and unlike a mutual fund in that you can trade them intraday just like a stock. Exchange-traded funds, especially a family like ProShares, offers individual investors a range of short-selling instruments that truly does cover the globe, as well as the fixed income side of the fence. So, for example, in a Forbes column that I wrote at the beginning of this year, I recommended an ultra-short 20-year treasury fund from ProShares. The symbol was TBT, because I felt that the 40% plus run-up in long-term 20-year plus treasuries in November and December of last year had simply created a bubble that was going to burst. And that call in that column has been one of my top-performing calls for the year. Right about now, I would say that all of that bubble bursting is priced in, so I wouldn't be a buyer of it today. But there are instruments out there that can let you engage in basically going counter to where many others think there still will be gains to be had.
What about, and you mentioned it earlier, Jim, what about investing in income properties as a way for a young person to start? I think the common myth about the real estate side of the equation is that it takes a lot of money to start. And there are properties that people can purchase as income properties with $5,000 down. What are your thoughts on that?
On the East Coast, we have something that we call triple-deckers. And it is very typical for a young investor to purchase a triple-decker for very little money down, obviously on the assumption of income generation, and actually live on one level and rent the other two out as a way to start their overall investment empire. And all I can say is I wish I had done it when I was a lot younger. But right now, in this particular environment, you've got to pay very close attention to the region in which you're located and the likelihood of return of demand in rental properties. We're already seeing demand return here on the East Coast, because especially I'm just outside of Boston. So in the Boston area, where we didn't see the implosion that, let's say, New York, Manhattan did due to last year's major financial meltdown, we just didn't see the scale of job losses up here. So inventory didn't flood the market. And as a result, it's still fairly tight. And I know that rental income is going up here, but property values as a whole remain fairly depressed relative to historical averages. So they look to me to be, especially in certain subsets of this region, to be very attractive, especially for a young investor.
Yeah, good stuff. What else would you like people to know, just to kind of wrap up the topic? Time is limited, obviously, of what they should know about getting a good start and staying on track with their investments.
Like anything in life, if you can set yourself a 1, 3, 5, and 10-year plan, it's going to be a lot easier to stick to it. Unlike most things in life, investing will actually end up being profoundly rewarding virtually every step of the way. For one thing, investing in and of itself makes you more aware of the world in which you live and a better participant in it, with the down-the-road potential for getting some demonstrable returns in terms of increasing the value of your lifestyle down the road. The other thing is that with the government basically spending itself into oblivion, if ever it was true, now it absolutely is so, that we really do need to be able to ensure our own financial futures. Nobody else is going to do it for us. And with a government that seems to be more rather than less inclined to tax successful people, you're going to have to be able to broadly diversify your portfolio to better take advantage of the kinds of incentives that a tax and spend government is going to impose upon an investment landscape.
And the incentives, and it's funny because most people think this is bad news, but it can really benefit you if you play your cards right. One of the incentives, of course, is you got to make sure you minimize your tax liability. That's a subject that just bores so many people, but it's the biggest expense anybody will have, right, Jim?
Absolutely right. And there are many asset classes that, really in every asset class, there are ways to basically minimize the toll the taxes take. And unfortunately, I think that toll is going to go up, not down, over time. So there's no time like the present to really begin to learn the best ways to make your money work for you.
Yeah. And so remember, economics is a relative thing, everybody. So if you minimize your tax liability and everybody else has got a high tax liability, by virtue of comparison, you're getting ahead. So that's a good thing. That's one of the sort of incentives, if you will. And the other one is inflation is probably coming at us. It's probably going to be pretty darn significant, I think. And there are some ways to really manage inflation well, because it's going to hurt most people. But people that get it, people that understand how to deal with it, can really benefit from inflation. Right, Jim?
No question about it. As in some other areas in life, other people's pain could definitely be your gain if you can keep level-headed, informed, and rational. The most important thing not to do, I would say, the classic investment mistake that I see every time, is basically trying to time the market. It is time in the market, not market timing, that creates wealth.
Yeah, that's sort of the Warren Buffett type of way, and I agree with you. People just got to get into investments and manage their own psychology so they don't do these knee-jerk reactions that really mess them up. Well, the book is Investing from Scratch, A Handbook for the Young Investor by Jim Lowell. It's on Amazon.com. And Jim, you have several other books, don't you?
I do. I would definitely recommend How to Survive in the Real World, which is a financial independence guide for recent graduates. And I certainly welcome people to click through to FidelityInvestor.com, where they can see one of my investment newsletters and read a Wall Street Journal article about me and what I do and why I do it.
Fantastic. Well, keep up the good work, and thank you for sharing your wisdom with us today, Jim.
Thanks, Jason.
Copyright the Hartman Media Company. For publication rights and interviews, please email media@jasonhartman.com. This show offers very general information concerning real estate for investment purposes. Opinions of guests are their own. Jason Hartman is acting as president of Platinum Properties Investor Network exclusively. Nothing contained herein should be considered personalized, personal, financial, investment, legal, or tax advice. Every investor's strategy and goals are unique. You should consult with a licensed real estate broker or agent or other licensed investment, tax, and/or legal advisor before relying on any information contained herein. Information is not guaranteed. Please call 714-820-4200 and visit www.jasonhartman.com for additional disclaimers, disclosures, and questions.